in the U.S. Air Attaché's aircraft, Colonel J. Thomas and company us was Commander McFall of the U.S. Navy. He was the naval attaché. And we flew out to across the same route that the Trans-Canada Airway took across Canada as far as Winnipeg, and then branched off up to the Paw, and from there to Churchill, and I think at Churchill we had an overnight stop, and then next day off to Coral Harbor on Southampton Island. Mm-hmm. Now, that's a pretty rugged area up there. There was still ice in the Hudson's Bay, and the ice stays in Hudson's Bay for a very, very long time, as you know. It doesn't go out early in the summer by any means. And Southampton Island must be all of 500 miles north of Churchill. It's well up in well up at the top end of Hudson's Bay. And it was a primitive base. Rocky Island, great expanses of sort of bald, smooth rock, good material for building, mm-hmm. building airfields, good foundation. It wasn't really nearly as great a problem with permafrost there, because you were building so much of it right on rock as there had been at Churchill. Mm-hmm. Now, Churchill was a different kettle of fish. Mm-hmm. Churchill, even though it's much further south, was still in the permafrost area. And we hadn't learned enough about building airfields there to do that without coming to a little bit of grief and severe maintenance problems in keeping the thing smooth and level. It tended to heave heave and blister and all sorts of things. But it gave a great insight, at any rate, into the difficulties of airfield construction and building construction and that you encounter in that part of the world. So I found it a very valuable trip. Now, when we returned, we came back the same route. We came back from Coral Harbor to Fort Churchill, and then on to the Paw. I'm just sorting two or three things out in my mind. I've done that trip on two or three different occasions. I'm hesitating there for a moment as to whether we actually got into Churchill, but we did. Churchill's a place that, time to time, has some pretty foul weather. You don't always get in there, and the alternate fields are a long way off, because the Paw is quite a distance south of Churchill again. But when we got to the Paw, we remained overnight there, and we were invited to go and spend the evening with the president of the Hudson's Bay Railway Company, who made his home in the Paw. Not absolutely certain, but I think his name was McPherson. I called him McPherson anyway. And we had a very pleasant evening with him, it wasn't too many years that the Hudson's Bay Railroad had been in operation. I had, in 1929, I delivered a new aircraft up to a place called Cormorant Lake on the Hudson's Bay Railway, up north of the Paw. And the trains that were going through back and forth then, on a rather infrequent basis, were carrying train loads of gravel up 200 or 300 miles up the line to dump in and fill in so that the railroad wouldn't be too rubbery on top of the muskeg. So we weren't too many years removed from all that, and it was interesting to talk to a person about the problems of building that, constructing that railroad. So we spent a very quiet, fascinating evening with them. And at the end of which, I guess it was a custom of that part of the country, we all sat down at the dining table to have a rather sumptuous snack before bedtime. At the end of this snack, there was, or I guess in the, someplace in the midst of it, there was large jars of caviar passed around the table. This fellow McFall, commander of the U.S. Navy, was a chap who fancied himself on as being a connoisseur of caviar. He was very fond of caviar, and he sampled it all over the world. And here he was eating top-notch caviar in great quantity. He just couldn't get over it. His eyes were popping. And I can hear him say to McPherson, "Tell me, how on earth do you have caviar of this quality and this quantity in a place like the Paw?" And funny expression came over McPherson's face, and he looked at his wife, and he said to his wife, "Should I tell him?" And she said, "Well, I guess maybe you'd better." So he told this story. He said, for several years, almost every time the train came down, or he said at least once a week, the chaps on the Nelson River who were operate our rail activities, there was a junction point at Nelson River, main servicing point on the railway. He said they as their hobby and sport, were catching sturgeon in the Nelson. And they, in fact, had caught so much sturgeon that they had started a small little industry. They were shipping sturgeon out, but in order to keep on the right side of the president of the company, each time they made a shipment out, they sent me a jar, a quart jar of caviar. McFall said, "I can't believe it. I just can't believe it. A quart jar." But McPherson says, "I haven't got to the punchline yet." He says, "For the first years, we wouldn't eat it. And we fed it to our chickens out here on the back." He said, "It's only this year that we really have got to the point where we think it's pretty good stuff to eat." And he said, "You're one of the first people that we've ever served it to." And sure enough, the caviar from the sturgeon in the Nelson River is of a high quality. And these fellows were shipping it out, but it wasn't going to Canadian markets. It wasn't being known in Canada. They were shipping out. It was all going to Chicago. And it was being used in hotels and nightclubs, high-class restaurants, one thing or another, in Chicago. So, I see we haven't got an awful lot of time left on that. How much more is on there?
Oh, quite a bit.
Oh, okay. Let me see where I'm going to go from here. I haven't really got down to talking about plans, and I think maybe I'll leave that to the next time. I'll talk about Bikini. One of the interesting things that came up during my assignment and there in the deputy air member of air staff was to go out to witness the atomic bomb trials at Bikini, the Bikini bomb trials. Abel and Baker, they were called. Each of the Allied nations was invited to send a delegation of the ex-Allied nations, and particularly those that had been associated in any way with the development of the atomic weapon. And it even went beyond that. Countries like Canada were invited to send representatives from each of the services. So we had, Canada had, I don't know just how it came about that Canada had, oh yes, and attachés were invited. Attachés in the United States, I think each mission could send one representative. I guess that was the reason there were two naval chaps from Canada. Because Nelson Lay, Horatio Nelson Lay, was the captain RCN naval attaché in Washington from Canada. And a Captain Harrison, who was a ship designer, was on loan from the RN, but was actually went as a representative of the RCN, was along on this mission. Colonel Flood from the Canadian Army, who was, in actual fact, he was a member of the National Research Council, serving with the Canadian Army during the war years, and he still was attached to them. And myself, we formed the Canadian delegation. That is, at our level, there were one or two other delegates at the medical level traveled on a different ship from ourselves. But I think the medical senior director general of medical services in Canada went out, and there were one or two other senior technical people too. But on the ship I traveled on were representatives from a number of different countries, and Britain was represented on the ship, and there were a lot of, I guess, now that I come to think of it, there were the British Canadians. The Australians, New Zealanders, and I believe, yes, all the rest were from various establishments throughout the United States. So we would be a group of about 100 observers aboard. It was a fairly extensive mission. It originated, we sailed from San Francisco on the USS Blue Ridge, which was what they called a command ship, mm-hmm. command and control type of ship. Fairly comfortable, nice quarters. Went first of all to Hawaii, where we spent a day or so, and then from there on to Kwajalein, and which was the center of the bikini trials. And I guess we were there for a week or two before the first trial took place, observing the manner in which the test facility was set up. The target ships were arrayed. There were a lot of capital ships, naval ships in the target array. It was one of the purposes of the test was to determine the extent of damage that ships could sustain within certain ranges of what they call ground zero, mm-hmm. so that there were ships anchored in sort of radiating circles out from the central point. And then, of course, on the deck of these various ships, there were all sorts of things exposed on which target information was being gathered, the susceptibility of certain things to destruction or to fire and so on. So there was a good deal to observe and witness in the array itself. And there was, although one at that stage wasn't permitted to see the atomic weapon, there was a good deal of information one could gather from the various briefings that took place on shore from the personnel conducting the tests. And of course, Canada and Britain had been in on the development of atomic power, if not on the atomic weapon. Britain knew a great deal about the development of the weapon. I don't know at that stage to what extent Canada did, but we were very active in the atomic energy field at that time. So between our British cousins and ourselves, we were able to piece together a good deal of what went to make an atomic weapon. That had added a little interest and suspense to the whole operation. And then came the great day when that first weapon was detonated. We, of course, had, the observer ships had been moved off to safe distance, and we were, but, and we could only look through very, very highly protective colored lenses, or do it observe it on the TV. They had a TV installation. You could actually, from within, see the explosion pretty well on TV, and then you could see that repeated because they could play back the TVs. It was really a most spectacular sight. It's beyond description. Of course, you've probably seen many photographs of that, the way that explosive develops and how it goes through various stages and ultimately leads to that big mushroom and then to that big dissipation on the top end. Then, of course, after the explosion, we steamed back, and after a certain number of days of examination and testing to make sure that the test area was safe to re-enter, we got back close enough to see what had happened to some of the ships in the target array. Of course, you could witness what happened to a number of them right on the TV replay. And some of the capital battleships went down. They had one or two Japanese battleships in the array, and they had one or two of the older aircraft carriers. One or two that had been rather severely damaged. The Saratoga was in there. It was a pretty famous U.S. aircraft carrier. She went down during the burst. So it, as I say, you could determine from the TV screen pretty well what had happened. And then, of course, after that brief period of examination, the whole thing had to be readied again for test Able, for test Baker, and the second test. In other words, the target array had to be redeveloped, and the surface targets upon or within the target array had to be reestablished, and all of the sounding and test devices which were used to determine the strength of the explosion at various elevations and at various distances had to be set up again. And that took a period of about 3.5 weeks, so we steamed off across the Pacific in the interval. Wasn't any point just hanging around Kwajalein and so on. We went over as far as Guam and had a nice little visit in Guam and went on to Truk. And a bit beyond Truk and saw some of the famous islands that had been prominent during the war in the Pacific, the campaign in the Pacific. And at the appropriate time, we returned once again back to Kwajalein to be in position to again examine the reconstructed target array and to be available and present for the test Baker. And Baker differed in that the bomb was released from an aircraft in the second instance, whereas in the first test it was tethered. That didn't make very much difference in the witnessing of the test, as far as we're concerned. It did make some difference to those who were conducting the test. And once again, of course, this was a pretty spectacular demonstration. The nature of the development of the blast and explosive was somewhat different because of the difference in the height at which it took place. But as the thing sort of took its final form and shape, it wasn't too different in the second instance from the that took place. And first, the results, of course, were appeared to be very similar in the two cases. And it clearly demonstrated that naval craft are pretty vulnerable. But it gave the Navy information as to what their range of danger area, and what the range of the danger area was, and what their reasonable safe distances would be from blasts of that nature. And it gave them a good deal of information about decontamination of ships. Now, for example, the ships that were not sunk were boarded, and after appropriate time lapse for the protection of the personnel who were going to board them, and were swabbed down and so on, and they learned a good deal about the best methods of decontamination of a ship after it's been subjected to a near miss. So I think that everybody got a lot out of that test. The Navy, Army, and Air Force of the United States who were conducting them, and the observers themselves got a great deal. I remember writing a pretty extensive report on this. I haven't the slightest idea where it is now. It was about an inch and a half thick, and it went into the files, into the safe someplace in Air Force headquarters, and what happened to it after that, I don't know. I think there were a couple of copies made. In those days, I was able to dictate at a fairly rapid rate, and I had an extremely good secretary who was keen to do something like this, and so we would sometimes dictate pretty far into the night, and she'd just pound away and get that out. And so I had that report out in very short order after the event. A lot of it contained material that was unclassified because we weren't... the Americans were very close with information, classified information, which had to do with the atomic weapons. But nonetheless, we were able to pick up a good deal of useful and valuable information. And of course, I'd come back with many good photographs. These were photographs which the American public relations people handed out, but they were photographs of the target array, of the development of the bomb blast at various fractions of a second along the time scale. And that would still be a fairly interesting report. It may be in some of the technical libraries, I don't know. Sometime I'll endeavor to find out.
What type of distance would you have been away from the blast?
I think that we were 10 or 12 miles, something like that. We were a good safe distance away. It was a very noticeable blast, of course.
I can imagine.
And a very brilliant flash. If anybody had had their eyes turned in that direction without protection, it would blind them. Whether it would be permanent blindness or not would depend on your distance from the ground zero, but nonetheless, it could be very severe if you were within a mile or so of it. So that... again, we stayed for further information on the results of that test, and then set sail from home for San Francisco. All in all, that was a 2 month expedition, and that took place in the summer of 1946. Someplace in the bowels of some of the safes in Ottawa, presumably there's a... Maybe in some technical libraries. I've never asked anybody if one of these volumes found itself in the technical library, but next time in Ottawa, I think I'll just ask that question. Well, it's getting a little late now, and I think that we'd better pack it up here. The next time, if you'll remind me, I will talk a little bit more about the planning aspects of my job as Deputy Air Member Air Staff. Planning within the Air Force, planning between the Air Force and the Army, the Air Force and the Navy. A certain amount of bilateral planning went on. And then there was a certain amount of tripartite planning that went on within the three services in Canada. And in addition to that, I was a member of a planning committee that operated between Washington and Ottawa. Tri-service joint and combined planning committee. Also, to some extent, I was associated with the Permanent Joint Board on Defense, in that my boss, Wolf Curtis, was an air member on the Canadian section of the PJBD. And that didn't always bring me into it, but sometimes I went along as his assistant, or in his absence as his representative on it. Notwithstanding that, I had to do with preparation of some of the papers which he presented at that meeting. So I was involved in planning insofar as the PJBD was concerned. So with those few remarks, I'll give you an idea where we'll pick it up next time. Very good.